Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in drummer, engineer, producer, and owner-operator of Drummer Boy Studios, Mr. EJ Porter. EJ, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Nice running into you the other night, man. It's just like, you know, everything's like full circle.
Yeah.
I just remember first meeting you at the music store, then Apple, then studio neighbors.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's always good to have, like, people that you can bounce as a musician. It's always good to have people you can bounce ideas off of and artists, engineers, other engineers who have experienced what you've experienced. And
100%.
Sometimes even having other experiences that you haven't had, you know, to bounce those ideas off. Because I think, you know, with us being in the same field, we run into the same issues and concerns and, you know, same pitfalls, and if I can kind of get some information from you to keep me from making that same mistake, then, you know.
That's what makes the world go around.
Yeah, you know, I think it teaches me to realize that whatever, you know, shortcomings I have or whatever things I think I know, that there's always someone who knows a little more.
You're right.
And, you know, for engineers, you always have to know an engineer who can get you out of a bind, right? Because
right.
Everybody always called the engineer to get them out of a bind, but I think every engineer needs to know another engineer to be like, yo, dude, my system crashed. What should I do? Or I'm having this crazy phase thing. What should I do? And you know, every time I pick up the phone to call you or stop by your suite and say, hey, I'm having this, and you'll be like, oh, I'll come over and take a look at it. So, you know, it's always a pleasure.
Making the world go around for a while.
Yeah.
So let's press rewind a little bit. Maybe I can get some of the story that I don't know. Where do you pick up music in your life? Because I know this has been in the blood of EJ Porter from the get-go. How does it start to come out in real life?
It started a young kid growing up in church and literally just having the opportunity to play drums, experience, you know, music from that set me. And my parents always wanted to put me around like anything that would grow me as a person, as an individual. And once they realized that music was really my thing, they just immersed me in it as much as they could. Like, I started off playing drums, but then they put me in violin lessons. And
how old are you when this is going down?
This is like five, six, seven, you know.
Early.
Really, really early. Piano lessons really early, you know, singing, all of that. And, you know, as a kid, you think that you just want to do the one thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if I can tell my five-year-old self, you know, hey, just wanting to play the drums is not enough. Like, I should have stayed more involved with playing the string instruments. I should have stayed more involved with, you know, playing piano. I should have stayed
What makes
involved.
You feel that way?
Because in production every day, you know, I'm calling guitarists up and saying,
right,
could you lay guitar? Versus if I would have kept playing the string instruments, I could have been laying my own guitar, playing my own keys, you know, being more self-sustained, you know, in production.
I got you.
Which I don't think that's the end-all be-all, but
no.
I think it would have definitely helped me and my more, you know, being a producer, because I would have had more instruments that I play myself that I could, you know, pull from and have those, you know, have those skill sets that we looked, you know, to others to have.
Mm-hmm.
And I still would probably work with other musicians, but it's like I don't have to wait for my buddy to come over. I can start on an idea myself. And if I still want to have him to play it, I can still have him to play it, but at least I have the skill set enough to, you know, get the idea down and play. So I just would have wished that I stayed, you know, more focused on learning other instruments besides drums. But I mean, I play a little bit of keyboard, and if I pick up a guitar, I can figure out a chord and strum something, at least get the idea out of my head until I can get, you know, a real guitarist to come in and really, you know, play the lick like I want it.
Right. So when you were a kid, did this stuff seem challenging, or did it seem like, man, I can learn all this stuff at once and you just chose drums?
I think it was the selfishness of wanting to give myself instant gratitude, you know, the gratitude of that's the instrument I'm very good at. And so I want to do that one because I'm really good at that one versus putting in the time and the struggle and the frustration to learn an instrument that you may not be as inclined to have that gift.
Right.
You know, and I think you know, for a lot of kids or, you know, people who are learning instruments or learning any kind of skill set, sometimes, you know, you're a musician. You practice the stuff that's easiest, you know, versus practicing, you know, all the scales and all the different keys. You want to play the line that is on the records that you're listening to versus, you know, really diving into your instrument and practicing the stuff that challenges us.
So what was the avenue for drums for you for that? What did you start playing first?
Anything, any and everything. Gospel songs, I would just put on the radio and just play to the radio, or definitely, you know, watching television and trying to play to the things that I hear on television. And a lot of I was always drawn to a lot of old school music. So I was always drawn to, like, stuff that Quincy Jones produced. For some reason, I gravitate to the type of songs that he produced because they was always so rhythmic, especially mm-hmm. the Michael Jackson stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of percussive drums and
Sugarfoot
stuff. Yeah, and the guitars. And so I was always, you know, that. And then I started listening to, I want to say it was like the Sting did a tour, and he had Omar Hakim on drums.
Yes.
And I watched that video all the time, and then it made me start. My big brother at the time, he was like, "Yo, you gotta go back and listen to Stuart Copeland." He's like, "If you think Sting, his personal stuff is good, you gotta listen to the Police."
That's right.
Then I went back and listened to the Police, and I was like, "Oh my God!" Like, like the songs, like, you gotta understand, this is like 80s, right?
Right.
And culturally, in Black culture, the Police wasn't it.
No.
You know what I'm saying? No.
There was a tinge of reggae almost, but we were out otherwise.
Yeah. And so it's like I'm listening to this stuff, and then they have all these like funny song titles and things, and you know, the song that I used to love the most is like a goo goo goo, a ga ga ga. This is, and I used to listen to the drum pattern on it, and he was like, he was such in the pocket, and
oh
the way
my God,
he tuned
yeah.
his snare, like he was playing the high pitched snare while everybody in the 80s was still playing like the deep rock snares,
right.
the 14x8s, and he was playing like a 5x14 or 5x13.
Yep.
And it was just cracking. I was like, oh my God, I love the way that snare drum sound. And so for me, that just made me want to listen to even more music and start wanting to play more forms of music than just, you know, soul and R&B and different funk and gospel. Was like, yo, this is a whole nother side of music that I felt like it was rock, but I felt like it still was like funky rock. You know,
oh,
it
yeah.
wasn't like...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Especially
like,
the Police.
Yeah, it wasn't like the traditional, what we would say rock is, you know, or what the rock genre is. I don't even know what they considered their music because, like you said, it did have a little bit of like reggae vibe to it. Like every song had like... it's like, and it had a groove, but then they go into like this whole, you know, bass and drums and guitar,
almost like punk.
Yeah, and so I didn't know what it was, but I know I enjoy listening to it. So that's what really kind of pushed me down that aisle of just like, hey, you know, you got to be funky, but you got to be in the pocket. You got to learn how to play these records because for me, that shaped my mind frame of what playing a record was.
Mm.
Like, because Stuart Copeland was like on. He was like dead, nothing fancy, but dead on. You
still
know?
To this day.
Yeah, you know, like dead on. So, I mean, that was pretty much my introduction, you know, to earlier drummers and trying to get into playing the drums.
So how do you take that introduction to a stage? You started performing at church first, I gather, right?
Yes, start performing at church first, and then I was playing, and people, you know, asked me, did I want to come and play at this other place here? And, you know, I'm young, so it's like when you realize you have a skill set that could make you money, you want to say yes to everything because you're thinking, hey, I can really, you know, while some of my other friends had, like, real jobs, there's nothing wrong with having a real job.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, yo, I'm going to go make $150 playing for this event over here or playing at this other church or something like that. And it was like, I loved it, but I realized it was something more, you know, that I had to be more than just a drummer. You know, it had to be something more to the craft because I know I didn't want to be stuck behind a drum set my whole life. But I love playing the drums. But I knew I had ideas too. I was starting to hear songs, kind of come up with my own songs. I was like, yeah, I need to be able to get these songs out.
You know, what do you think triggered that? Or they were just in there, and once your music started to develop enough, they got to the surface?
I would always hear, you know, melody lines in my head, and, you know, me and my sister and my brother, you know, would always sing and, you know, hear little things. And so I knew I had the gift of writing music, but I didn't know at that point it was writing music. I just thought I had the gift of just, you know, hearing these melody lines and trying to figure them out. And I realized maybe about 14, 15, I was like, I have to start putting these things down. Like, you know, and I got to start working on a little small keyboard where I could sequence and trying to get some of these ideas out of my head down. I realized, hey, I can't just be the drummer. I need to be able to command the other people who are helping me facilitate getting this music out. So right. I need to more jump into like that producer role to say, okay, I know what I'm hearing and I know what I need you guys to play for me to hear what, you know,
is what's in my head in real life.
Yes. You know, and that's probably the most frustrating. I mean, as a producer, as a songwriter, I think it's frustrating for artists. I think it's frustrating for, even to this day, I still get frustrated because some things that you hear in your head, you can't quite articulate them. And right. So you have to work with people, different, you know, musicians and different artists to get it out, that it sounds the exact way that you hear it in your head. And, you know, the funny thing about, you know, God-given gifts is that they shape themselves in your head, and you may not have all the resources to reproduce what you hear in your head. So in your head, I'm hearing like a full symphony, and now I have to go and try to pull up the best, you know, Philharmonic soft synth patch, and it's still not sounding like I hear it in my head because right. I'm trying to play it on a soft synth versus having a, you know,
actual 30, cellist 40, or whatever.
You know what I'm saying? So that's where I still get those frustrations, you know, as a producer and as a songwriter, is that, you know, you still want to create to the highest level. You want to create what you actually hear versus feeling like you're settling. And sometimes the settle point is, it's good. The message is where I want the message to be. The groove is where I want the groove to be. Okay, I don't have the full, you know, orchestra. I don't have the full horn section, but I got it as close as I could get it. And sometimes it passes.
Yeah.
Other times it doesn't. And, you know, as a producer, we'll tweak a song all day.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like, because you're trying to get it to that finish point that you hear in your head or what you know the vision should be.
Right.
And everybody around you say, it sounds good already. Like, why you listen to this song 1,300 times? It's because it's still not right yet. You know, the vocal is still not sitting exactly where it's supposed to sit, or, you know, the orchestration or the strings or the bass is not where you want it to be. And so I think that's a demon I'm probably going to, you know, battle with my whole life.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's probably a definitely. So how do you go from you just get the first keyboard and you're putting some sequences in to the point where you're actually able to start working with other people to bring your stuff to life? Where does your production skill start to develop?
My production skill starts to develop when I was writing these songs, because I wasn't a performer in that right. Like, I could sing, but I wasn't going to get on stage and sing my own songs. So I was writing these songs. My sister and them, they had a group together called Solution 4. That was their little girls group. And I started writing songs. They were the only group that I knew that would allow me to write songs. And I can kind of not force my songs on them, but be like, yo, here's a new song. Do you want to try it out? You know,
right.
And actually get in the studio with them and say, hey, sing it this way or perform it this way.
And how old were you at this point?
At this point, I was about 15, 16. And they were 12, 13, 14, something like that. So, you know, it's cool having that experience, but I was figuring it out, bro. I was just trying to get someone to sing my songs. And I didn't have a large enough outreach. You know, the internet is not what it is now. So
right.
It's not like I just get on the internet and say, hey, I got free beats. Who want to, you know, sing over my songs or rap over my songs? And I'm very much a hands-on person. So I don't even know if the internet was available like that then, if I would still use that approach. Because
right.
I like to be in the studio working on the tracks with the artist. I don't want to send you my song and hear what you wrote, and now you do it your own way when you go to. I actually want to be in the studio working on the song with the artist, because I feel like that's the role of a producer. I just don't want to be just a collaborator, but I want to actually produce the record. So the record has the vision that, you know, that's in my head, or has a collective vision of me and the artist working together. But sometimes, you know, working in different states, you can't all the time be that hands-on.
Right.
So it's still a challenge for me to this day, sometimes working like that.
So would you say that the reason why you prefer working in person versus the back and forth that we all kind of get involved in is because if you work in person, it creates more of a collaboration than it does?
And I think you get the synergy. You get the synergy of actually working with people, and the vibe and the spirit of the song, you can kind of talk that into someone else. Like, if I sing you a song, you hear the beat, I can talk to you on the phone and be like, yeah, this is kind of style I'm looking for, do this. But if I'm not in that session with you, when you sing a particular note or
right.
you know, a particular lyric, I can't stop you and say, hey, let's take that lyric again, like it have a little more feeling, or hey, draw that note out a little bit longer so that, you know, we can get the emotion of that lyric. Sometimes you're not able to do that. And so you're kind of leaving it to the person and the engineer
right.
who's there to record it and send you back something. And, you know, it can get expensive, because you send me back something, if I don't like it, I'm going to say, hey, we need to record it again. But at that point, who's paying for it?
Exactly.
You know?
And how much time did you lose?
So for me, it's like, yo, can we just figure out a time? If they're not in the same city, I tell my clients, hey, can we just figure out a time? You come down, I want to be in the studio with you. I want to make sure that we're recording this song right and that the song has the feel that we're going for. And sometimes, you know, as we very frequently talk about, sometimes the artists don't know how to give it that themselves. You know, they have their gift is their voice.
Right.
But their gift may not be to be a vocal producer, or their gift may not be to be a producer. And so I need to use you at your strongest gift. If your strongest gift is your ability to sing and hold a note, I want to tap into that ability of yours versus trying to tap into an ability that you really don't have and that you're thinking that you have to have, because now I'm not in the room with you. So you're self-producing yourself. And
right.
You know how that can go.
Yes, I do.
You know, sometimes you look up and you get a good one, and then sometimes you're like, the song is still missing something. And she's singing her butt off on the song, or he's singing his butt off, but it's still missing something. And a lot of times, it's no direction. It's the producer's not in the room to help give them the guidance to bring the song to completion.
So I was going to ask you something else, but that actually brings up something that I'm very curious about your feelings on. The word producer now is this word that I feel kind of got hijacked by people who are actually musicians or composers or whatever. How do you feel about the role of producer in the traditional sense that you're talking about, where you're there to be like their Sherpa? I'm showing you how to get to the top of this mountain, not sing for you. How do you feel about the landscape of being a producer?
I feel the reason why the term start to get used so loosely is because, you know, people like me and you were missing. We wasn't invited in an equation.
Right.
And so, you know, I have a lot of guys who are mentored that's new in production. And I tell them all the time, I say, right now you make beats. You're not a producer yet. You know how to sit in front of your keyboard, your computer, whatever. And that's a skill. That is a skill set.
Yeah, amen
itself.
To that. Yeah.
You know, not taking anything away from that skill set, but you haven't learned how to produce yet. And it's okay if you just want to be a beat maker and say, hey, I do 30 songs a day and I send them out to people and I send them to other producers to actually have them to really produce the record.
Right.
But I think that term producer started becoming very loosely used because they were giving the credit of producer to the beat maker. And sometimes the beat maker doesn't know how to lay down vocals, doesn't even know melody lines, doesn't know how to pull out the best take out of, you know, the artists, the singers, the rappers, and they just start using that term because that's what they thought the term is. Versus I come from, you know, the mind frame that the producer doesn't have to play one instrument on the record.
Right.
The producer doesn't have to write the song. The song can be fully written, arranged, and composed by somebody else, but you still need the producer to bring the song to what it's supposed to be. And usually, you know, in the most formal sense of it, the client, whether it's the record label, the management company, or the artist, will hire the producer because they trust the producer knows how to do that job.
Right.
And I think a lot of times now, because of lack of funding and lack of resources, somebody sends them a beat and they go to the studio and make the song by themselves. And so technically the song has no producer.
Right.
And sometimes you can hear it. I mean, you may look up and come out with something that sounds, you know, halfway decent. And then you say, hey, I produced that myself because I gave myself the direction. You know, but I'm from, you know, where the producer literally booked the studio time, decided who they wanted to engineer that project, who they wanted to, you know, be the master engineer of that project, and who they want to be the mix engineer. Because based on the type of record we're making, I'm going to these guys. You know, if I'm making, you know, a rock record, you know, there's a lot of guys who can probably mix rock, but you know, I'm going to Chris Lord-Alge. That's where I'm. That's who I'm gonna go to as a mix engineer for a big rock record. If I'm making a record for, you know, Lil Baby or one of these urban, he's not gonna be my mix guy,
right,
for that record. But the producer would know that, you know, versus someone else who doesn't know that kind of stuff. They're gonna just say, hey, he's good, let's just go to anybody, you know? And I try to pair, you know, the projects that I work with people who I know who can help bring that project, you know, to its best form.
Yes.
You know, from musicians to producers to other engineers, you know, songwriters, because I want to make sure those songs are sounding authentic as those songs can be. You know,
do you think that's because when someone describes to you where a song needs to be, or you can hear where it's at, you're doing what you did when you were younger, you're hearing everything that's missing, you're hearing it beyond it, and it's now your job to try to bring all the things in your head?
If they want it to be your job, because a lot of times those are the battles that I'm having with the client, is that, you know, they don't hear where the song can go. They have a very limited perspective of what they think the song could be. And I'm saying, yo, this song can be huge if we added the right arranger to this song. If we added the right instrumentation, this could be a bigger song than where you see it. But, you know, that's where the relationships and the trust comes, because the clients, they have to trust the producer that he's not going to steer them wrong, and that they have a mutual vision for the project, but I'm never trying to overshadow what my clients want for their song, because at the end of the day, it's their song.
Right.
And I can't be more married to the success of the song than you are.
Yes.
If you have a limited...
How hard is that to manage, though? Because that's a real thing.
No, it is. It's a real thing, to the point where sometimes you're frustrated because you see where this thing can be. Like, this could be a huge song, and you're realizing, but the people I'm working with can't see beyond, you know, their Instagram followers. And, well, what if I make a song like this? That's not my followers don't want to hear that type of music. Yeah, but what if this is a record that's not meant for you to sing anyway? It's a record that we're supposed to get to another artist who can really blow it out, you know? And I'm listening for that kind of stuff, because I realize every song I write and every song I make produce may not be for me to take it, you know, to the next level. It may be I may be able to produce a great demo just to introduce the song to a Miley Cyrus who can make it a big song like Flowers, you know?
So how do you keep yourself from getting precious about the things you write or play? Because that's what happens to people. They get precious about things.
You gotta love the process enough to realize that everything you write and everything that you may write and produce is not for you. You know, I love music that much to realize I'm good at some things, but I'm not good at all things, you know? And I'm not selfish enough to say I want to do it all, because I think that's what happens. Like, we get into this place where we're selfish. We want to do it all. We want to try to, you know, we want to have our name listed everywhere on the credits.
Yeah.
Versus, my best analogy is, I'd rather be like a 10% stakeholder in a $1 billion company than to be 100% stakeholder in a $10,000 company.
Right.
it just, the numbers just make sense at that point. That if I touch enough things, I'm not trying to say all the magic needs to be created by me, but I just want to be a part of the magic when it is created.
What helped you develop that kind of selflessness in the creative process? Because that's not an easy thing.
It took me having a couple of situations where I fumbled and I messed it up because I was trying to hoard it and do it all myself and realized that we were actually missing the goal. Me being, trying to be in control of it was, we were missing the goal.
Preciousness backfired.
Yes. You know what I'm saying? Versus saying, hey, you know, maybe there's something that you can add to the to the project. Maybe there's something someone else can add to the project. And if it's going to make the project better, I want to have their opinion on the project. You know, I'm not saying having 14 songwriters on one song, no. But I'm saying having the intelligence enough to say, I've done all I can with this, and maybe it's time for me to involve somebody else in on this that can help us really hit the goal, you know? It doesn't happen. I mean, I'm such a strong believer that no one gets there alone, and it doesn't happen by just the works that we do with our hands. It's the works we do with our hands, the relationships we make, the networking we do, and being able to share our gifts freely with other people. Not for free, but share our gifts freely. That's something that I'm doing. If I feel like it's important enough that you can offer something to help this, hey, I'm going to say, hey, take a listen to this record. What do you think this record need? I can't get the mix right. What, as an engineer, what do your ears say? And if you say, hey, the drums are too loud, when you back the drums down, the vocals are washed, I'm taking that into consideration because I realized I came to you for some advice. I'm not getting it right, so I'm trying to get it right. And sometimes listening to other people helps you get it right.
So that's almost the unique role of the producer reversed.
Yeah, it is. But how many people really want to listen to that type of advice? I mean, how many clients you know that you work with that really knows how to just say, I don't know it all, and I'm totally depending on you to help me get to the finish line. I don't know a lot of artists who can put that kind of pride.
I was
going to
say that usually doesn't happen until you got like a record under your belt and the second one you start. So that actually brings me to what my next question I wanted to ask you was. It seems like I was going to ask you, what's the most important thing to try to get these best takes out of people or the best takes out of yourself? But I think that the answer to that question is the trust.
Yeah.
So what do you do or not do to have that trust with your clients so you can get to the point where you can be the most effective in making them the most effective?
I try to sit down with the clients, you know, and just talk. I don't want to work on music. I need to just talk with you. We need to go and, you know, grab a drink or go grab something to eat so that you can just talk who you are, you can see who I am. Because I think once you know who people are, you have an innate ability to trust them because you're like, okay, they make good decisions when it comes to, you know, who we should bring in as the bass player or the guitar player. And just play a bunch of records. I think music kind of brought us here anyway. And so
good point.
You just, you play records and say, okay, what you feel about this record? What you feel about this record? Then people start trusting your creative opinion that play some really good records, especially when you're playing stuff that is not the mainstream stuff, but you realize as a musician or you realize as a producer that was a good record that literally slid, you know, under the radar because it maybe didn't have, you know, they maybe wasn't a big budget artist or they're not, you know, super known, but they make great music. Side note, I fell in love. I was on Delta and catching a flight to go to Africa. And they're playing like the Spotify playlist or whatever, the curated little playlist as they're, you know, as we're loading. And I'm just chilling. And a song came on called No Cities Left by a band called The Deers out of Canada. And I just literally fell in love with like their music to the point where I went and did research and listened to like four or five. That whole 16-hour flight was me diving into all of their previous works. And I was like, these guys are really good, but they just kind of slid up under the crack. Like, Rock Band, really good. The lead singer has such a rich voice, And his name is Murray. I can't figure out what his last name is right now. But such a deep and rich voice. And so I was talking with another client, shared the story, played the music, and they were like, bro, that's dope. Like, I never would have been introduced there if you never would have, you know, brought it up. And I think that's how you build people's trust, is that you play the stuff that speaks to you, the stuff that touch you. Because once you play it, if it's really dope, I feel like stuff that I get very excited about, people understand that excitement is a genuine excitement. It's not an excitement to sell them on me. This has nothing to do with me. I'm excited about another artist's work. And I want to be just that excited when I finish creating songs with you.
Ah.
You know what I'm saying? Because I think everybody wants you to be excited about their stuff. You
yeah.
know? And I don't want to be, I'm excited about it because I created it. I want to be excited about it because we worked on something together and that you love it to the point where you want to share it to all your, you want to walk out the studio right now and play it to all your friends. That's one of the best feelings in the world, to know that, you know, we've built something so good in such a short amount of time in the studio. And sometimes it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you know that. You know, sometimes the first session is like, ooh, what did I get myself into, yeah. right?
No comment.
Then the other sessions are like, okay, we're working out. We're starting to see eye to eye.
Right.
The music is starting to happen. The gel is starting. The synergy is happening. And I think that's where the trust is really built, is when people see that regardless of times that y'all may disagree, that you're still, you know, interested in working on a project, you know, unless it gets really bad. And then sometimes you just have to cut your losses while you're ahead.
Yeah, that's just not everybody works with everybody.
Yeah, and I get it, but I try to still, I'm the type of person that I'm still trying to work it out, because I feel like we're here to do what we both love. We both
right.
love music.
Right.
Why can't we do it? You know, we're not trying to have a marriage here, but sometimes the relationship between the artist and the producer can be a good marriage
yeah.
or a bad one.
Right.
yep. You know, and it's like the bad marriage, producer-artist relationship, it's almost like neither of us want to be here, but we know we're better together than
yes.
than
that's
a
such
part.
A unique thing.
You know, like neither of us want to really be working. Like, I hate going to studio. But then you realize, but this person really gets me.
Right.
And when we click and make the music that we're supposed to make, we're both happy about the music. It may have taken us some adversity to get to that part, but when it's said and done, it's like, oh, we love what we came up with. You know. And I love those type of sessions. I love those type of sessions where we're trying to figure out, you know, the power dynamic between the artist and the producer. Because at some point, the artist has to just let go and say, I trust, I came here because I know you can give me something. So I trust what that is you're going to give me. I just think through communication, you figure out what they're, because everybody doesn't know how to tell you what they're looking for.
Right.
They don't.
Well, they're not necessarily supposed to. Singers don't have the vocabulary of an engineer.
They don't have the vocabulary, but, you know, they're using words that they think you would understand them. And
right.
I'm sometimes like, it's the terminology.
We're
saying the same thing. We're just saying it in different ways.
Right.
You know, I'm going to say the record sounds a little muddy. You're going to say the record sounds dull. Or
yeah.
you're going to say the record doesn't have
too much low end.
Too much low end. Yeah. We're saying the same thing, but we're all trying to get to the same point. The point of how do we correct it and have a great record. And for me, I'm always about, like, I think that's what the creative process is like. It should be a push and pull.
Yes. There's value in that.
It is. I don't feel like that's a bad thing when it comes to the studio. I
think as long as you can get through it.
Have to get through it. Because yeah. the goal is to figure out what that is, solve it so you can get to the end, right?
Right.
But I think a lot of people, they say, oh no, we you know, we clash, so I just walked out the studio. I'm like, that's not, if you don't know how to work that out, you're gonna always experience those same difficulties with other people. It won't just be with me. It'll be with the next producer. It'll be with the next engineer that you don't like the way they said something. And I'm learning, like, my vocabulary in the studio, if I don't like something, I don't like it. And I can't fake it.
No. Well, you're an engineer, not an actor.
Yeah. Like, I can't fake it. If it was a bad take, it was a bad take. If the take doesn't have feeling, if the take doesn't feel, you know, authentic, I don't like it. And sometimes singers are listening to how they sung it versus the feeling I get. And I try to go for the feeling of what the lyric came across as versus how you sung it, you know, because it can be a little pitchy.
Right.
I can straighten it out. Give me the feeling. We can, if that's a little small, you peaked a little bit, you distort a little bit, I'm going to try to correct it. But if I can't correct it, I'm going to leave that distorted take in there because that take had the feeling that I needed for that part of the song. You know how many records have mistakes on them?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're an engineer, so you listen to, the good part about being an engineer and a producer is you're listening sometimes from the engineer standpoint, which is sonics, you know, the science of why things sound the way they sound, you know. And then I sometimes have to listen to from my producer's ear, which is, you know, the feeling and the musicality of that. And I will always take musicality over sonics.
Oh, yeah.
Always. We know those old records don't sound as good as the new. Just the recording techniques back then weren't as good as they are now, you know?
Certainly not as refined.
Not as refined, yeah. But those records have a sound. And when you listen to Hotel California, it's a sound that comes with that record. Not just the instruments that they're playing. It's the sonics, the sound that whatever they captured in that room, you hear it on those records. You hear it on ABBA. You hear it on the Bee Gees stuff. You hear it on these old records. You know what I'm saying?
Those Bee Gees vocals. Yeah, good Lord.
You hear it and you say they were tapped into something in that session. And sometimes I just want to be a fly on the wall in some of those recording sessions because I realize, you know, people are actually having fun. And you
damn
can
right.
But you can hear the fun on the record.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't sound like one person is saying, do this. It sounds like there was a collective effort of musicians and people in the room saying, hey, let's try this. Let's try to sing it this way. Let's try to play it this way. And then when you hear the end result of it, no wonder those records are like platinum selling records. Like,
yeah,
because if people got the feeling of the record, you know?
Yeah, and that feeling doesn't change with time. That actually brings up something I wasn't intending to ask you about, but let's take a little jog off to the side. You mentioned Hotel California. As far as I know, that's still on the greatest selling album of all time.
Yeah.
Okay. We're 40 years plus removed from that.
Yeah.
Okay. How much do you think technology has helped recording, or how much do you think has made it so we're never going to make Hotel California again?
Why did you have to ask me that question? Because that's such a loaded question in the sense of this. For the record, I appreciate the things that technology has brought us.
Same.
But I think also we start depending on technology so much that we stop depending on the musicality of records. And so it's like now, I say the laptop is the newest instrument that was invented in the last 100 years, right? The most prolific,
I suppose,
new
so.
Instrument that has brought us to this is the laptop. And I'm saying the laptop as a whole. Whatever DAW uses, whatever DAW uses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the ability to be able to drag and drop samples, sample things, record things without having to play an instrument, without having to learn an instrument, has had its advantages. But I think it set us back in the sense of that we no longer listen to what a real guitar sounds like.
Yeah.
So we no longer listen to what a real bass sounds like. We no longer listen to what real drums sound like. And so we're using all these technology pieces that somewhat are dulling our ears and experiences of having live instrumentation and the joy that having four or five people in the studio playing those live instruments bring you and add to the record, right? Versus one person clicking and dragging themselves. They don't have to listen to the guitar player and say, hey, you know, let me take that take again. I don't like the second chord I played.
Right.
You know, because now you're doing it by yourself. You know, so I think technology has helped us, but are we really gonna make records like that again? I don't think so. I think people are making great records in the digital domain.
Of course.
Great records. There's a lot of great records out there that sonically sound. I just think sometimes, and I have to tell myself, don't worry about the sonics all the time. Like, it's good. Leave it alone. You know, you don't have to have the latest, the greatest, the newest.
Right.
You know, these records were made on 16 tracks. They only had 16 tracks.
Some of them was less.
You know what I'm saying? They had to figure out how to bounce, you know, loop that.
Reverb from the basement.
Yeah. And they were making the best records they could make. But even at making some of the best records they can make in their time, those records are still holding up to records now.
Right.
Sonically and numbers-wise. Like, those records are like, you know, I think Hotel California and I want to say Thriller or yeah. Billie Jean. Like, 74 million records sold?
Yeah.
You're not gonna get 74 million records out of anybody right now. 74 million?
Yeah.
Physical records?
Yeah. That's not
at
happening.
$15.99 a piece?
Yeah.
$19.99 a piece?
You can barely get it at 99 cents a piece.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you're not gonna get that, but they were putting in the time to make those records actually have the feeling and the sound that they have versus.
And that still translates.
It does. Sound translates. Feelings translate. I think the stuff that we are trying to be so clear and clean about that, you know, we want to get all these nice, you know, pop filters and isolation, and we're going to isolate this from isolating that. And like, yeah, but some of the tones we're hearing on those records are the harmonics of things not being isolated. You know? And so now it's like, okay, but we want everything to be so isolated and it actually sounds so clean that it feels put together versus like it organically happened.
Right. It's almost engineered instead of played.
Yes. And I want to get back. And I think there's a time for both.
Right.
But I want to get back to where we're actually playing records versus putting records together, you know, and actually having the fun experience of creating with other people in the room. I think there's just something special to create. And I love to create by myself. I do. It's hard for me to have people in the room, but I realize once I have people in the room, I mean, it's vulnerable for me to have people in the room.
Yeah, right.
Because I don't know what's happening, bro. Like, I'm thinking through it. As you're watching me, I'm thinking through it at the same time, so I don't have all the answers. But when I hear what I like, I know that's it, right? Mm. Versus sometimes I think we want to have the answers because other people in the room watching us. And I don't need to have all the answers. Like, sometimes it's not me. It's I gave you an idea. I hummed the idea to you, but once you put on your guitar and played it, you actually made the idea what it is. I just gave you a starting point, a blueprint. But the song is really, you actually helped co-write the song through your ability to interpret what I gave you as a blueprint, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes, you know, we don't have that kind of synergy or that creativity with people in the room because we're in the rooms by ourselves versus having other people there,
right?
You know?
You brought up a good point. No one's selling 74 million records. No one's selling really many records anymore. Monetization as an artist has gotten to be really weird. I don't want to say it's hard because some people make money.
No, the ones who are making money have realized the monetization is not just in the records. They monetize their brand. They monetize who they are, the feeling that they give their fans. You know, they're probably not selling as many records as they could sell, but they have other things that draw their fans and draw their followers in to want to support them.
Well, when you're producing a record, and this is something I used to have to think about, but it's been a minute for me. When you're producing a record, how much are you thinking about what your artist is going to be able to do with this, even if you do make the dream come true? And the record sounds good.
You're right. I do think about it, but I try not to get caught up in thinking about it because I think sometimes when we get caught up in thinking about it, we start producing for external factors versus producing for us.
Good point.
You know, now we're trying to produce by, will radio pick this up? I don't want to worry about any of that when I'm in the studio. I don't because I'm overthinking the process. We should be having fun in studio and making music that we like, not making music that we think others will like because that's so obscure. We don't know
what they're going to like. It's almost impossible. Yeah.
You know, so I think we have to make the songs that we like. And if we love it enough, I think it gives us enough happy feelings and it gives us enough encouragement to actually put it out there to people and have a very positive outcome about it for yourself. I love the song, so I know you're going to love the song versus we're hoping people love our music. And I think, you know, when you start thinking about the monetization, it's scary for artists, because I read something on social media that said artists have to pay for the production, pay for the engineer, pay for mastering, pay for the video to be made, pay for
marketing
and promotion.
Ugh.
All to just have all that money spent hoping someone loves it enough to pay for it, for them to make a fraction of that back. That's a lot of pressure on. I don't have that kind of pressure on me as the producer.
See, and that's why I was wondering how much that creeps into your head or how much you can think about it all, because it is exactly what you just described.
And it can be exhausting. Like, me thinking about it as a producer saying I want to be an artist, that could be very exhausting. Besides the fact that I own my own studio, so I don't have to pay for studio time. I can engineer my own project.
Play your own drums.
I can play my own. You know, some of those things I could kind of get away with not having to shove out the money, but the marketing and promotion is still real. You have to pay for that. You know, you have to pay for the, you know, the graphic design and pay for, you know, the videos and the things that you can't do. And that's scary that, you know, you may be in on a project. At minimum now, you're in on a project, let's say on a small scale, at least 5,000 per song.
Right.
You're in.
Yeah.
How do you make that back? When I've got my BMI statements and looked at my streaming, you know, and I'm like, bro, that song had 700,000 plays. That song has almost a million plays, and they're giving you $200, $300? For artists, if they don't have another way to support themselves, they'll make one song a year because that's what they can afford to make. And me and you both know they need to be making 2 songs a month.
Right.
Minimum.
Because half of that's never going to see the light of day.
Exactly.
And it'll make the other half better.
Yes. It's like, but that's a real, you know, challenge that they are having, that I hope artists are not being discouraged by it, because I think they have to find a way to, you still have to do it. So you either network with people who have common interests, common goals, or you decide I'm going to do it at the most streamlined budget possible so that I can still stay involved in the process. Because if you don't do the process, man, you know, music is not like riding bikes. You know, they say, hey, after you learn to ride a bike, you'll never forget, right? Music is not like that. I can walk away from one DAW for a little bit and start working in another one and have to go back to that one. I'm lost, bro. I'm on YouTube University trying to figure out how to do the bounce again. You know,
yep,
because
100%.
Everything changes, and that's from just an engineer's standpoint, a producer's standpoint. From an artist's standpoint, if you're not releasing songs and doing what it takes, it's so many other people who are doing it every day. You know, there's a kid in his basement in Iowa somewhere who's making 30 songs a month, and they may not be good, but he's.
But you're 29 songs behind him now.
Yes. And at some point, he's able just because he doesn't care. And I wish artists would go back to don't care. I hate that sometimes when artists come to me, I give them so much information that it scares them. And I'm trying to just give them information because I want them to be knowledgeable about what the process really looks like. But sometimes having too much information makes you afraid to do.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel like I wish I wouldn't have never said that to them, because I wanted them to be just the
naive. Like that kid in the basement.
Yes, that I'm just going to make songs and I don't care about having marketing promotion. I don't care about having, you know, a video. I'm going to shoot a video with my iPhone. I don't care about having all this other stuff, because it keeps you still in the process of doing. And I think, you know, as artists and producers and creative people, we still have to create.
Right.
Whether we're scared, whether we don't feel like it, you still have to do it because it is a lifeline for us.
That's really valuable advice. That's facts. You got to do it.
Got to do it, you know? And it's scary because you don't want to do it, because every song you do, you think that's going to be the one that's going to pop off for you, right? All the artists, they think every song they do, oh, that's this the one. And I'm like, no, that one may not be the one, but it gets you to the one. You make the bad song so you can get to the good song, right? And you make all these other songs because the process of making the music makes you better at making music.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the process of making music makes that song better. No, it just makes you better at the – it's a process. Everything we do is literally a process. And if you know how to do the process, you can do it. And that's why the professionals are the professionals.
Right.
You know, the big boy producers, that's why they're good at what they do, because they can walk in the studio every day and they know the process. They may not feel creative that day, but they know the process enough that they can walk out with something. And it just pushed them closer and closer and closer to the finish line.
So that innate ability to keep in the back of your mind, it doesn't really matter what's this like, as long as we're moving forward, we'll get to what it's like.
Yes. But everybody can't see that perspective of it.
Right.
Because everyone wants the song that they're working on today to be the one that, you know, blow up. And sometimes it only takes one song. I mean, you know, we are in the time that you can have one hit and it can go viral on any one of these social media platforms, and that can be the one song that kind of takes you to the top. And I always say, well, what's next?
Right.
You know, where do you have the next one? Because now you have a whole different type of pressure on you. You have the pressure. Right now, the pressure to fail is not as on our shoulders as much as the pressure to want to succeed.
Mm.
But after you succeed, the pressure you have on it is not to succeed. The pressure is that
to not fail.
Right. And somebody's going to say, I'm a failure. I'm a one-hit wonder. I don't care. If it was a one-hit song, you do it. I mean, no disrespect, but for all the artists who had like those one-hit songs, I would love to have Ice Ice Baby by Vanilla Ice. That song made him a cultural icon, literally.
Yeah, well, it launched his entire career. I mean, he's still living on that song, essentially.
That's what I'm saying, versus people who feel like, no, I don't want to have just one song that... No, that one song did it. You have to just have other things to kind of do something else with it. And if not, I'm going to keep performing that song. They're going to book me everywhere to perform that one song if that was the song that kind of did it for me. You know what I'm saying? And that's no disrespect to Vanilla Ice. I'm just saying...
No, I know. Absolutely not.
It was a great experience for him, and even other people may try to down it, but it did what it was supposed to do. We're here 30 years later, still talking about him.
Right. Yeah. Haters can't say much about it. You know what I mean? And some people did have some fun doing that, guaranteed.
Yeah, but I think where we are with creating and being musicians and studio owners and producers, you're in a spot where as long as you keep doing it, there is fruit from what you do. You may not have a number one hit. You may not have a number one Billboard hit. But, you know, I like the stuff I create. And I still have it on my playlist. And I play it when I'm in my car. And I play the songs that my friends have that nobody else ever heard, because those songs still speak to me. Those
right.
songs still have an emotional place in my heart, you know, and
right.
that I think as we create music, if we go back to creating music for that purpose and not the purpose of, oh, I want this song to blow up, because you're putting your efforts into the wrong part of creativity. Like your efforts is, I want this song to blow up, I want this song to blow up. What happened to, I just want to write a good song?
Yeah, right. What did happen to that?
Nobody cares about a good song, because it can be a good, great song with, you know, 300 streams, or it can be a okay song with 300 million streams.
Right.
And the general public is going to say the song that has 300 million streams is a great song.
Right.
No, it's just a marketed song that was marketed and promoted well, that they put resources and finances behind to make that song good. And sooner or later, I think we will get back to the place where we have to stop looking at the metrics of music, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just, does it feel good? Do I like it?
That used to have to come first.
Used to. But now everything is, you know, we didn't know. I mean, you have to look at when CD sales, and I know I'm dating myself, but we had to look at CD sales. Like, there was really no instant metric of CD sales.
No, you had to wait a week at least.
To see what the sound scan reports are.
Yeah.
Sometimes even 2-3 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, you can look at a song, and if the views on YouTube is not going up, and if your Spotify streams are not, you think yourself is a failure, versus
right.
patting yourself on the back and say, I completed something that 40 million other Americans couldn't do. which is I at least released the song.
True. That's a perspective I think that people forget.
Yeah. You know, that there is an achievement to just following the process through. Just getting through the songwriting process to the recording process to the mixing and mastering process to the graphics and design to actually releasing on these platforms. Like, that's an accomplishment in itself.
Do amen to that.
You know, we didn't – you grew up during the same time I did, so we didn't have that – that process wasn't so easy for us. We actually had to go and find a CD person who did duplication and had to do the minimum order, which most time was like 100 or 500 to get a good price.
I was going
to
say, I was doing like 2,000 of my first ones, and it's like,
yeah. Yeah, it's like, what am I doing with all this product, right?
Yeah.
It's like, now, they can literally do it, upload it, and it can be available tomorrow. And
right.
Like, the process is so easy, so they don't appreciate the process. I always appreciate the process, because I feel like that's an accomplishment in itself. You did something. You got this creative work outside of your head, out of your heart, onto some type of tangible listening platform.
Yeah, that's appreciating the process is huge. So I wanted to ask you about one other thing, sort of aside from this, but you brought up owning your own studio.
Yes.
You've been doing this for how long now? Over 10 years, right?
I've had my studio. I moved in 2010, so 14 years.
Yeah, okay. So what do you think has helped you last this long? That's a long time period.
Being friendly with clients and trying to always help people to see their vision, to see whatever their goal is. Because I think people appreciate that more than they appreciate the service that you provided. Anybody can provide a service. You know that. There's hundreds of studios
right.
that people can go to. People go to places where they feel like they can get their work out in a reasonable time at a reasonable price, and they want to go places where they feel like people really want to see them win and support their projects.
Mm.
And that's what I'm about, man. I really want to see artists, old, young, achieve their musical goals. That's like a goal of mine, is to see them achieve their goals, because I think, you know, it's so hard to make it in this business. It's so much, you know, negativity. And so as a studio owner, it's like, I want to see those artists. When they come to me, I love to see the new artists come in and say, hey, can I record? Yeah. And I let them record. And the first time them listening to themselves, you know the feeling.
Yeah,
they're
sure
sitting
do.
Back on the couch.
That's why I'm smiling. That's why I'm smiling.
And it's like, they are so happy that that's them.
Mm-hmm.
They can finally hear themselves. That feeling doesn't, I've experienced it 1,000 times by now. Right?
Right.
It still gives me the same happy feeling when I see a new person experience that. Because for them, they feel like they're on their way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and you provide something that you do effortlessly, that you do every day in and out. For them, that was a challenge. And you help them overcome a challenge by something that you do effortlessly every day. And so a lot of the clients that I have, they appreciate that in me, because they know that, you know, I'm really trying to help them. I'm not just trying to take their money. I really want to help them, because I'm realizing at this point in my life, I have to work with people that satisfy something in me because my creative time is way worth more than my engineering time. You know, I'm sitting with these people trying to help them create and help them get their vision out, their, you know, their music out, their goals, their dreams, whatever that is. And I need to be compensated, not just, you know, financially, but I have to have that feel good point too.
Because what happens if you're only compensated financially?
You know what happens. You get burnt out, because none of the stuff is exciting to you anymore.
It's actually exhausting.
It becomes exhausting, because now it actually turns into a job. When you're having fun, doesn't feel like a job. I'm at work, but it doesn't feel like a job.
Good point.
But when you're just taking their money and they just coming in, it's like pressing R or 3, and you're just like, and they start to kind of feel that you have this whole thing of just record versus you're trying to actually
be involved.
Help them be involved.
Right.
And I think people want engineers in sessions who want to be involved.
Because, so do you think that's where the engineer line now gets blurred with the producer line?
So when I say be involved as an engineer, I think engineers have to always, they have to have an ear as well. I don't think you can be a dumb engineer anymore or a non-musical engineer.
Right.
Because you still have to listen to things that you know as a engineer. If they step back too far from the mic or whatever and you heard that change in volume, you have to be able to say, hey, can we do that line again? This time don't step back or whatever, because it's going to make your job harder at the end of the day to give them a quality recording. But I do think the line gets blurred when, as a producer engineer, you start taking on the role of producer when you should only be engineering.
Mm.
Because you can't. One is a way more expensive, costly, you know, process than me just recording you.
Right.
And if I give you that, you will never know the difference between going to a studio where they actually produced me. This guy was just an engineer.
Right.
You know, and I think those artists have to have, they have to have the distinctive line, because if they don't, they start expecting that everywhere they go.
You're right.
And then they get somewhere else and say, oh, I don't like going over there because they just let me record. And I was like, that's what the engineer's supposed to do.
He's then not, we come full circle where they forgot what a producer is.
And then they figure out what a producer was. Yeah. Yeah, he's not supposed to tell you he didn't like that line or to do that line with a little more confidence. So that wasn't his job.
Right.
His job was supposed to make sure that the level was good and that your vocal hit the meter where it was supposed to hit, and that, you know, it's a great take. That when he finishes the product, he can send it to any other engineer or any other producer, and people are going to say it was recorded well.
Right.
Not necessarily it was performed
the best
well.
Takes, yeah.
Yes. You know, and so, but I think I do blur the line at sometimes with some artists. But I just try to be a little more open with them when I blur the line and say, hey, I'm jumping in right now as a producer, but just know an engineer normally wouldn't say this.
So you verbalize that.
Oh, yeah. You have to verbalize it, because if they keep asking me to do that, then it's now we need to come back and have the conversation of my producer rate is this, my engineer rate is this.
Right.
How would you like for me to serve on this project with you?
Right.
You know, because that is a, that's a perk sometime of working at a studio where the engineer is a producer. You know, that's the perk of sometimes when I send my records out, you know, to be mixed by engineers who are producers, because they understand sometime how to shape the song where they're doing some arrangement sometimes in the in the mix down. You know, there was a lot going on here, man, so I just kind of pull these instruments out right here to let this part have a little more space so that when the chorus came back in, the chorus sounded bigger.
Bigger,
you know. But I don't mind doing it. I just have to make them aware that those are two different processes.
Understood.
Two different jobs.
Well, that's a lot of the nitty gritty. Let's get you out of here on something fun.
Okay.
I'll give you an A-B choice. Either you could play drums with any band, any time, any gig you want, you name it, or you can produce a session with any artist you want. Which one is it, and who are they?
Drums. I'm going to actually pick the drums. And this past summer, I got a chance to see, I was in traveling, because I love to travel. I was in Sweden and decided to go over to Copenhagen. And
dang.
I saw the last two shows, Elton John, retirement, farewell to the Yellow Brick Road.
No way.
Bro, I'm a fan. Like, I went with my friend because she's really a fan, but I wasn't a fan. But I was like, this is a great experience for her. She'll get a chance to see it, you know.
Yeah.
After I left that concert, I was like, I want to play drums with Elton John. Like, he has those songs, bro.
Yeah,
like,
facts.
He did 3 hours.
Damn.
3 hours. No breaks.
What?
3 hours.
That's earning it.
His whole band been with him for 50 plus years.
Good Christ.
All the musicians, like most of them. He had a younger guy who played a keyboard, but his percussion player, his drummer, he's like, they've been with him since, like, they came to him in 1972. So 50 years.
Wow, I did not know that.
And I was like, that probably has to be one of the funnest gigs to be playing with your friends for 50 years.
No kidding.
Doing the shows that you want to do. And these, it was sold out. And I'm not even a big Elton fan, but after that show, I was calling home, like, from the engineer standpoint, the sound was immaculate, the song selection, and he played the piano for 3 hours, an acoustic grand. Like, I'm wondering why his hands are not hurting. I was like, yo, I would love to play. Those are the type of tours, not a bunch of smoke and mirrors, you know.
Right.
Not a bunch of pyrotechnics, no stem tracks. And I have nothing wrong with stem tracks or, you know, pre-recorded tracks, because I do it with my band sometimes.
Yeah.
But for him to play that type of show for those people there.
And every bit was performed.
And every bit was performed. And to see him at 76 years old, 74, however he is, perform and do a three-hour show, I was like, yo, I would literally leave the studio to play those type of gigs.
Well, that was a curveball. I didn't think Elton John was going to be the answer, but good one.
Who you thought?
I mean, I didn't really think. Saying, I didn't really
that's
think.
That's just one that it was an experience. And I've been to a lot of shows.
And the professionalism off the charts.
Professionalism off the charts. Lighting, sound, everything crystal clear. And it's just, his show was just amazing. I was like, Elton John is that dude.
Facts.
You know, and I was thinking, like, you know, looking at other artists, more contemporary artists, but for him to be doing it that long and to know that he still knows how to have this audience in the palm of his hand mm-hmm. for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. I want to say he did 40 songs.
That's 40. Wild.
I'm not talking about snippets. 40 full songs. From everything. Like, he went his full career, like 16-year-old Elton John to 65-year-old Elton John, like 50 years worth of freaking music. And I was like, he's a genius. And I never had that feeling in a concert ever in my life.
Damn, sitting that's wild. There,
like, it was just, and I didn't stay on my phone. Like, it was one of those situations that I didn't want to be on my phone. I just wanted to be in the moment. Because I knew I was experiencing a moment that most people would never experience. And especially knowing it was the show before the last show that he said he's, you know, farewell to forever.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, I'm sitting here in Copenhagen watching Elton John, you know, like five rows from the front. And I didn't have tickets that day. I walked outside and somebody said, do you need tickets for the show tonight? I was like, sure. I thought it was like, it was going to be like a scam.
Yeah.
He literally was like, give me X amount. I think I gave him the equivalent for three tickets. I gave him the equivalent of like $700. And he walked me right in and was like, your seats are right there. I thought he was joking. They were floor seats, like, like five
you
rows.
You can't script
front.
That.
I couldn't. And I was leaving the next day to come back home. So I literally had to see the show that night or I would have missed it.
Wild.
So it was like, God,
that's the
bro.
Universe working out for
yeah.
you. Yes.
Yeah. So Elton would be definitely. After that, I came home and I played Benny and the Jets and all these other songs he had. Like, he really has his songs are awesome. He's a great songwriter. If Elton, if you're watching this video, like, one show. Just let me get one show on the drums. You can go back in retirement after that. Just one show.
I will put it in on the link. We'll tag it everywhere. Well,
please
EJ,
do.
I got to tell you, man, I really appreciate you coming down. I'm so grateful to hear from you, man. I miss having these conversations, and we could go for a lot more hours. But, you shared so much valuable information. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and amen, man. Thank you.
So I got to ask you one question.
All right.
Keep the hotel empty.
Yeah.
What is it about?
Okay, no one knows this. I don't know. We going to leave it? We'll leave it.
You're going to leave it?
Yeah. Everybody gets this before they film.
Oh, okay.
Keep the hotel empty. Long story, short as I can make it. I had a list of names. Turned out I thought I wasn't going to do the podcast, but we ended up doing it, as we know now. I had a list of names, and this is the one that kept coming up. I couldn't find online where I had found it or how I got it, so I got to make up my own meaning. So this is something no one ever hears. I literally keep the hotel empty so I can welcome you in.
Wow.
And I figuratively keep the hotel empty in that we have no agenda. I'm not political. I'm not trying to get you to say anything.
Gotcha.
I don't want to paint anybody in any light.
Yeah.
I just want to let everybody be themselves.
That's great.
Thank you for being yourself today, brother.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, man.